This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Primary voters in New Hampshire hit the polls today as America dives into its first presidential race since the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act of 2002. But our guest Charles Lewis says the new law hasn't made the world safe for democracy. Lewis heads the Center for Public Integrity, a D.C.-based nonprofit that doggedly tracks political contributions and assembles reports on special interests at work in Washington. Lewis and the Center have published a new book, The Buying of the President 2004, which concludes big money is still finding its way into politicians' campaign chests. The book is in part a reference guide, including lists of the top 10 contributors to every presidential candidate. Charles Lewis spent 11 years as a producer for ABC and CBS News before leaving to found the Center for Public Integrity in 1989. I spoke to him last week. He said presidential candidates now have to raise a lot of money the year before the election to be seen as serious contenders in early media coverage.
It ends up being very detrimental to the other candidates who maybe can't raise that much. So if one's raising 30 or 40 million and the other is raising three, then the storyline, you know, months and months before Iowa and New Hampshire is that someone is a loser and can't find any support. And you frequently see candidates drop out months before the actual primary season starts for that very reason. And a lot of people are very frustrated by this. They call it the wealth primary or private referendum, where the people that actually select some of our choices at the front end are sort of faceless, nameless. I mean, you can find them in the records somewhere, but they are writing checks. And the people who write checks and max out the $2,000 contributions and things like that, 90% of that money goes in the year before the election. So it is a lot of the election, a big part of it, occurred already last year.
You said a private referendum, in effect, of contributors that occurs before the rest of us get involved.
That's right.
Let's go over some of the Democrats that are still in the race and tell us a little bit about where they get their money and where they are on issues of campaign integrity and accountability. Howard Dean, now, you might look at his internet-based fundraising campaign and think it's exactly the kind of broad-based Democratic effort we'd like to see in campaigns, is it?
Well, his numbers are very low. As a Vermont governor, and they have limits up in Vermont, unlike Texas, a lot of Bush's numbers are high because he was from a state with no limits. So Enron is his top donor from when he was in Texas. Dean's top donor is 65,000, approximately one-tenth of the Enron numbers, partly because of the function of Vermont. Certainly, the internet phenomenon with Dean is very, very interesting. It will be studied for years. It has revolutionized fundraising. Candidates in 2000 used the internet, but not anywhere near as effectively as Dean did. Being able to raise 800,000 to a million in a single day is really quite, amazing and unprecedented. Now, a lot of donors outside Vermont have begun to flock to Dean. In the fall, it appeared he was in the summer and the fall, he started to look like the possible nominee. So you have Time Warner, Microsoft, IBM are his top three contributors. But the amounts of money are pretty low, and they're executives inside those companies, presumably. $65,000, the top donor. The other second one is $25,000. And so the amounts of money he has raised are not very large in the general context of candidates at that level as a major presidential candidate. He does have a closeness to companies in Vermont. For example, the utility industry has given him thousands of dollars. His former chief of staff went to become the chief lobbyist for the largest utility in Vermont, and there are some ratepayers who are still fighting mad about favors they perceived were given to the utility companies up there. So he is actually acknowledged that special interests have access that's uneven and unfair compared with other citizens, and that a candidate can be influenced. He's been open about that. He hasn't been that open about his records, which we also talk about in the book.
John Kerry is a longstanding advocate of campaign finance reform. He's refused to take political action committee money in the past. Does he put his fundraising conduct where his mouth is?
Well, no, the short answer. He's gotten in some brushes, scrapes himself with scandal. Remember Johnny Chung, the funder who mysteriously gave money to Clinton and went to prison, and there was another fellow named Paul from Florida. These were associates or donors to Kerry, and he had to give their money back over the years. But he has raised large sums of money. His top donor is Mintz Levin, a law firm in Boston that his brother is a partner at. They represent Atlanta Telecom interests, and Kerry is on the Commerce Committee in the Senate. He has assisted some of these wireless and other high-tech telecom-type companies try to get favors from the Federal Communication Commission. So he has gone to bat for his donors. Now, some of those companies are probably in Massachusetts, and he would argue, you know, that he was helping his constituents. But there is a pattern of assisting donors and doing things for them and having a – he's on amazing committees. He's on the Finance Committee and the Commerce Committee, which means those two committees have jurisdiction over every industry in America. If you're a donor and the guy's a three-term senator, you need him. He needs you. He needs money. They need access and influence over their agendas. And he takes a lot of their money, and he has been helpful to many of these companies over time. It's not a dollar-to-dollar relationship with any of these politicians, but occasionally they get what they are seeking, and they certainly have substantial access.
What should we know about John Edwards?
The two things that are noteworthy, one is probably well known. Yes, as a trial lawyer, a very successful trial lawyer, he is very close to the trial lawyers. And so 22 of his 25 contributors are trial lawyers or, you know, law firms or lawyers. But the other thing is he actually is a freshman senator and only in politics for less than 6 years. He has the biggest single contributor in the entire book, which is a real, you know, man bites dog fact, at least to me. Shangri-La Entertainment, Stephen Bing in Hollywood, who's a big Democratic Party donor, has given him $907,000. Most of his other donors are $400,000 or under. But that's somewhat interesting. That shows sort of the Hollywood thing that sometimes happens, particularly with Democrats, where they get excited about a candidate or two. We need to know a lot more about Mr. Bing, which, you know, I'd like to know more. But that's what we noticed right off. And then we have lots of things in the book about his cases and how he rose to fame and his background personally. But that's the story with his money.
Wesley Clark, the retired general, hasn't spent a lot of time raising money. He did do some lobbying. What should right. we know about him?
Well, yeah, he is – a lot of the Clinton fundraising network has embraced Clark. We added the Clark chapter after we finished the manuscript. He entered the racial recall back in the fall, and so we added the chapter. And a retired general doesn't have a long record of contributions in his career, but he's now raised about $13 million in about 3 months, which is pretty impressive for any candidate and especially for a Democratic candidate. And so they're from all the sort of usual suspects, a lot of big business interests and union interests and others. And we're still waiting to see some of the numbers on that because the fourth quarter hasn't come out. The most interesting thing is the lobbying relationship. He was a registered lobbyist at the time he announced his candidacy, September 17th. He was trying to help this company called Axiom get government contracts, including airport security and other contracts, including defense. And it's not unusual for a retired general to help contractors get contracts. That happens, unfortunately, way too often. But it is interesting because he was an analyst for CNN talking about the war during Iraq and talking about airport security in the U.S. and other homeland security issues while he had privately had been reportedly lobbying the vice president personally and other top officials inside the Bush administration and doing everything he can to help this company. He is publicly being a quote-unquote neutral analyst, and the viewers were never informed of that. And it just shows how complex Clark is. He's setting up a committee to run for president. He's a retired general helping a contractor, and he's on TV as a commentator, all simultaneously, all the same person. And the public didn't know about one of those three things.
Charles Lewis, you've written that George W. Bush has redefined the parameters of fundraising. What did you mean?
Well, no one has ever seen numbers like this. He raised $125 million in the 2000 election, including nearly $70 million the year before the election, or put differently, $230,000 a day in 1999 compared to Al Gore's $84,000 a day. So he, you know, those were astonishing numbers in 99. He has now raised $130 million this time, the year before the election. He has $99 million cash on hand with no primary opponent. This is just radically transforming American politics. Numbers have never, ever been remotely seen. The champion fundraiser of all time we thought was Bill Clinton. And this guy nearly tripled the numbers of the Democratic candidate back then. And so when you look at it that way, that's one reason we've never seen anything like it. The other thing, and the way he has done it, is the pioneer system. He has found a way to bundle contributions in a highly sophisticated way where he can find an amazing number of people willing to write checks at the maximum amount. The maximum contribution today is $2,000. Back in 2000, it was $1,000. It's been increased with the McCain-Feingold legislation. But
now, you've noted, I think, that they have a sophisticated system of coding each contribution internally so that they can track who gets credit for it. What's the significance of that in this bundling process?
Well, the significance is, and this there's a lot of deposition and question and answer testimony that's really quite interesting from the McCain-Feingold Supreme Court case where they admit this stuff. They say, well, yeah, the industry has to get credit. And you've got to think, why do they want credit? Well, they want credit because they're going to be back asking for something. That's why they want credit. And why else would you care? I mean, the pioneer person, the person who raises $100,000 is called a pioneer. The person now, this election, who raises $200,000 is called a ranger. And they do want to get credit that it goes to them personally, so they get to be called a pioneer or a ranger. So that's, you could argue that's the only reason they do it. But there is actually comment from a utility executive who went to college with George W. Bush, who is a pioneer, who said, we want our industry to get credit. And he actually put it out in a letter to his other industry fellow executives. Now, and you know, the utility industry has gotten certain favors from the administration, and so you've got to think they knew that they would have close access to power. There was also personal familiarity, and they were giving astonishing sums of money bundled together, and that's sort of how it worked. We write in the book that this election, because of Bush's fundraising prowess, has the chance to be the most lopsided financially since the Nixon-McGovern race back in 72. I mean, the Republicans, because of Bush's prowess raising money, there's still a kind of a difficult situation here in terms of accountability and openness in our political process, to put it mildly. And one party in this instance, the Democrats, is frankly terrified that they are completely outgunned and they're scrambling to try to recover.
What do you think George W. Bush's particular fundraising genius is? How do you account for his enormous success?
I think his genius is that he has found a way to organize a donor base nationwide to an uncanny and extraordinary extent, where industries are clamoring to outgive each other, and they all get credit for the giving, and it's all understood, and it is shameless and unabashed bundling of contributions, which goes against the spirit of the post-Watergate laws. It is highly organized bundling. And, you know, you have to give them credit. It's brilliant. I mean, it's ingenious. And it's entirely legal, I should emphasize. There's nothing illegal about this. It's just disconcerting that so many people are giving all these contributions from industries, getting credit for the contributions and boasting that their industry has given them the most. And then we notice later they're getting various dispensations in Washington, and you can't directly say A calls B, but don't tell me 2 + 2 = 7, because it's pretty obvious to us what's going on.
Now, you recount what happened in 2000 when John McCain got off to a very good start when he was challenging George W. Bush for the nomination, and then came the South Carolina primary, which you write epitomizes the profoundly disturbing state of American politics today. What happened in that primary that tells us that story?
Well, what was profoundly disturbing to me was that facts don't matter. As an investigative reporter, facts to me are very, very important. And not only did McCain get mugged, figuratively speaking, in South Carolina, he had won New Hampshire. He's on the cover of all the magazines. And 19 days later, he's a failed candidate. His national campaign's dead in the water. What happened? Well, what happened is Bush outspent him 5-1. And outside groups came in and dumped millions of dollars as well. So you had more than $20 million probably spent in South Carolina to McCain's $3 million. But you had a lot of mysterious groups, from the Confederate flag to, you know, normal groups that are frequently associated with the Republicans, such as, you know, anti-abortion and those kinds of organizations, all lining up around, without officially saying they're part of the Bush apparatus, sending out phone banks, emails, leaflet drops, radio ads in the 11th hour that are very hard to detect who paid for them. Bush never said he had no idea why this was happening. He was on, you know, he took the high road in all of his, in the latter days of his campaign. And when it was all said and done, not only has McCain's candidacy stopped cold, but the exit polling shows that voters thought the reformer was actually Bush. Bush had run ads calling himself the reformer with results. When you study his record in Texas, he never reformed politics. He, in fact, was an opponent of campaign finance reform. And so by running an ad repeatedly, almost into the ground, and at every appearance having a sign behind his head that said reformer with results, the public began to think that he was really a reformer.
Anybody interested in campaign finance reform would have to say that this, you know, 2002 was a huge year, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. And it was upheld by the Supreme Court. How much of a difference will it make? How far will it go in reforming the way we elect our public officials?
It's not a panacea. It is an incremental beginning. Yes, soft money has been ended officially, and there are some limitations on these issue ads as they run in campaigns. But presidential candidates still have to go out and raise $100 to $200 million from private sources. Conventions, we give a check for $12 million, but they go raise three or four times that much from special interests. Three candidates, Kerry, Dean, and Bush, have opted out of the presidential matching fund system, which would seem to suggest that system is broken. If it's going to continue, it's got to be seriously changed, I think, by all accounts. Yes, the McCain-Feingold thing was huge because it was the first major piece of legislation since Watergate, since 1974 in the U.S. And, you know, it took, as we all know, it took McCain almost a decade to get the thing passed. You know, you know how everyone understands how hard they worked to try to even get it on the agenda. For three full years, the Republican Congress in the mid-90s would not even put the legislation on the agenda. That's how hard it was to get this thing to climb the hill on this. And the president signed it holding his nose, proverbially. He went off to a fundraiser after he signed it. He didn't have a public statement for TV or radio about it. He quietly issued a little statement and left town, and then, of course, authorized his party to try to overturn it in the Supreme Court behind the scenes. So this has been a very tough road, and you know, these reformers are fighting mad, and they feel emboldened. I mean, they're actually feel they've been validated by the Supreme Court, and they're getting ready to come back with a whole laundry list of changes in American politics. And the other side that lost is astonished, taken aback, licking their wounds, and getting ready to continue the fight in other trenches.
A lot of what you do at the Center for Public Integrity is to develop information and shine a light on that exposes relationships that otherwise wouldn't be known. And as somebody who's done political reporting, I've written a lot of stories over the years about political contributors who've gotten government contracts or favor or you know or favors and apparently in return for contributions, and I've found that they don't have a great effect. I mean, I find that I've had politicians tell me, "Yeah, I know if I take a contribution from this company or something, I'll take a media hit, but frankly, it's worth it because in the end, it doesn't matter that much." I'm wondering if you kind of feel the frustration as someone who constantly cries out about the truth but gets ignored.
Well, I'm not in therapy yet, but yes, it does bother me. It is frustrating. I mean, let's be honest. It doesn't matter to the politicians because half the electorate doesn't participate in democracy anymore. 100 million Americans do not vote. A lot of the folks that don't vote are poor and disenfranchised from the system economically already, and they've just essentially given up. They think that they don't matter. They can't get through to politicians. So the politician desperately needs the money, and who do you think they're going to listen to? The person that doesn't vote, or the voting bloc that doesn't vote, or the folks who are paying their bills for their consultants and their polling and their ads? And so it's very clear to see what has happened to our process. It's becoming, you know, not a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, but some people and folks who have checkbooks. And you know, at some point, as a people, the public has to speak and try to get their government back, whether it's at the local level or the national level. The question is, will they mobilize? Will that start to happen? And you see glimmers of hope occasionally where there's a pulse. There's a media ownership vote, and nearly 3 million people contact the Federal Communication Commission as recent as last June. Now that's unusual. That's interesting. That's not typical. Most of the things that happen in Washington are behind closed doors. The hearings are mostly peopled by lobbyists paid to be there. And the process is sponsored by these elite interests. A $1,000 or $2,000 check comes from 0.1% of the American people. That is who is substantially sponsoring our politicians today. And it is frustrating to continually chronicle it. And this is the third buying of the president book. But, you know, we are going to continue to go into the brick wall here and keep tracking it just because I guess we're masochists.
Charles Lewis, thanks much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Charles Lewis, director of the Center for Public Integrity. His new book is The Buying of the President 2004.